I'm Britt Garner.
And I'm Rob Spall.
Welcome to Nature Insight.
Speed dating with the future.
You may be wondering, why speed dating? Well, it's all about getting the most important bits of information across in a short period of time. And that's just what we're going to do. I'm a science teacher in New York City in the US.
And I'm the head of communications at IPBES, the World Biodiversity Platform for Science and Policy, here in Bonn, Germany. So, Britt, another week and another chance to explore how science and evidence can help us all to make better choices. Who are you introducing us to today?
It was a real pleasure to chat with biodiversity scientist John Donaldson. He's one of the three co-chairs of the IPBES Sustainable Use of Wild Species Assessment.
And that's going to be a major new report. After 4 years of work by dozens of experts from all over the world, it's going to be considered by IPBES member states and then hopefully released on the 8th of July this year.
Now, is there a release party? Like, should I get a dress? What are we doing? I think airfare should be obviously covered by IPBES. Do we have thoughts here? Should I crowdsource?
I'm thinking your social distancing might be about the space between New York and Europe.
That sounds about right. Though I will say, for me, I am just as excited about the release of this as I would be any major movie or book or piece of media. It's just, it's so incredibly important. Though, despite my excitement, John is not actually able to share any previews of the findings with us just yet, mm-hmm. because those are confidential until the report is published. But even so, we were still able to delve into why the sustainable use of wild species is such an important topic in general. You know, Rob, I actually get the feeling that a lot of people don't realize that almost all of us use and benefit from wild species of plants and animals every day.
Many of our remedies for coughs and sore throats actually contain ingredients sourced from wild plant species. So when we're talking about the sustainable use of wild species, it really can be part of the problem if we think of it being about people other than ourselves.
Right, instead of it being a shared issue and something we all interact with. And it's something that John and the team are keen to highlight in the assessment. They've been working on it since March of 2018. First, I asked John what sparked his interest in sustainability.
What happened in my case was that during my PhD, one of the plant groups that I was looking at was a group called cycads, which turned out to be one of the most threatened organisms on the planet. And the main threat to cycads is overexploitation. So literally, as I was going around in the field collecting insects from these plants, I was seeing these populations disappear. A lot of the common names are cardboard palm or sago palm. They have their genesis way back about 280 million years ago. So they're the oldest living seed plants. They're referred to as living dinosaurs. But what's happened is they've become highly collectible plants. And we've had six extinctions in the wild of cycads in southern Africa within the last 100 years, five of those within the last 20 years. So over time, I kind of morphed into looking more at the cycads and more at the issues around trade and use. And so I got more involved in that aspect of things.
For the sustainable use of wild species assessment, there are quite a few words. And I think that these words actually matter quite a bit. One of them is the word wild. What do we mean when we talk about wild species?
You know, essentially, even if you look at large mammals, for example, they range from being in entirely unmanaged systems with very little human intervention to places where they might have some human intervention, just say supplementary feed in times of trouble, right through to being very intensive interactions where there might be interventions around breeding, around veterinary care, etc. So it's about where we draw the line in terms of what is wild and what's not. And I think what has also been a really important component of this is also realizing that many of the landscapes that we think of as being wild and that where we think of the species being in them as being wild actually turn out to be strongly influenced by human actions. Even in the Amazon, which we would kind of regard as being sort of this pristine wilderness, there's now increasing evidence that the diversity of trees and things that you get in certain areas is influenced by the nurturing that happens because of the human populations living within the forest. So there's increasing evidence that even what we might think of as pristine and wild is also still influenced by people.
I was in school in Montana, and with the national parks there, at least for the United States, there are people that go to them specifically to see wild spaces. And the fact of the matter is they are almost more curated than, say, Disney World. So it's very interesting, the stories we tell ourselves surrounding these words. And I think people probably don't realize that they might use wild species every day. Can you think of some examples that people might constantly interact with but don't really think about it?
There's often this perception that the use of wild species is for somebody else, that it's people in Southeast Asia who rely on diets that use a lot of wild species, or it's people in poor countries or poor areas like Africa that rely much more on use of wild species. But actually, it's much more prevalent and widespread across the world than that perception leads us to believe. So nearly 50% of the fish that's eaten is wild caught. Cosmetics use a lot of wild species. So shea butter, for example, is largely wild harvested. In South Africa, we have a wild plant called Pelargonium sidoides, which is included in elixirs for coughs and sore throats. The edible wild mushrooms are a growing industry, and species such as Matsutake mushrooms, chanterelle, bilitis mushrooms are harvested from the wild. So there's not the separation that there's some people who use and some people don't. And that's a really important point, because as we start to look for solutions, as we're trying to do in the sustainable use assessment, it's far more helpful if we see ourselves as part of the problem and the solution, rather than seeing it as this is somebody else's problem and we need to find a solution for it and maybe impose that solution on a group of people. We're all involved and we all need to find a solution.
Completely agree. And I love that you pointed that out. So do you think there have been any really significant changes, like over the course of your own experience and career?
One of the big changes has been just in our understanding of what sustainable use is and how it gets managed. You know, Eleanor Rostrom won the Nobel Prize in 2009 for her work that demonstrated how people work together to manage shared resources sustainably. And there's also been additional developments on the greater knowledge of community-based resource management, especially in Africa. But in addition to that, there have also been large-scale changes in population pressure, globalized markets for goods and services derived from wild species. And these are important implications, just that whole change in scale, both the scale in geography from the way people were locally managing a species to not being regional or even global, and just the scale of use, so from often relatively small levels of use now to much larger and often commercial levels of use that are linked to global markets. For example, you know, the issue that's come very much in front of mind in recent times is the trade in pangolin and pangolin scales. So pangolin has been traded in Africa for a long time as part of, you know, people's diets, so that's nothing new. What has changed substantially is that the demand in Southeast Asia for pangolin scales has now made that a global market. So suddenly you've got new actors coming into Africa, and the scale of the use and the scale of trade has increased substantially over time. You know, we've seen similar things in South Africa with, you know, if you take a plant like Hoodia. So Hoodia is a succulent plant that was used by the San people as an appetite suppressant when they were out hunting or traveling. So they'd cut a small disc and put it under their tongues. So it was, you know, used at a low level by indigenous people in Southern Africa for, you know, probably centuries. But it was suddenly discovered that this was a drug that could be used as part of diet pills. And so it suddenly went from this very low level sustainable use to a substantial, almost industrial level global use. And that had huge implications for the sustainability of the harvest. And then there's also the increasing illegal trade. You know, the illegal trade is prevalent in logging, it's prevalent in fisheries, and it's also certainly in the public mind become very prevalent in the issue around endangered species. So trade in rhinos, trade in ivory. But it is an increasing issue, an important issue relating to the use of wild species.
As you've been working on the assessment, have there been any success stories or moments that stand out to you?
One of the big focus areas of the sustainable use assessment has been Indigenous people and local communities and Indigenous knowledge systems. There's an increasing recognition that areas managed by Indigenous peoples have better outcomes for biodiversity. That's come out, it was part of the global assessment, it's come out of several other scientific studies recently, and there's been a big policy shift globally in recognizing the role of Indigenous peoples. And that really is an important link to sustainable use, because use is often envisaged as exploitative and seeing wildlife as a commodity, but most Indigenous cultures don't see the separation of people and nature, but seeing it as one. Their systems and their management of the environment includes the use of wild species. So it's an integral part of their value systems and their way of being. There are also some spectacular examples of changes linked to use. So the one that's often used as an example is the vicuña from South America. The vicuña is kind of the wild version of the llama from South America. It's one of the finest fibers available and very high quality products, mostly traded in Europe. So the vicuña had been hunted to near extinction in the early part of the 20th century. So there were only about 6,000 animals left. And then through CITES, they were put on CITES Appendix 1. CITES is the main convention that regulates trade in wild species. And the population then increased to in the tens of thousands. And then it was then transferred again to Appendix 2, where some trade was allowed. The populations have continued to increase because local communities are involved in the harvest. It tries to use Indigenous practices around the corralling and the shearing of the animals. So there have been these examples of where there have been substantial shifts and where sustainable use is possible and has been shown to be effective.
I know that within different value systems and thinking about use of wild species, I experienced that a lot in Montana with wolves. There was an idea, a while back, we're protecting wolves because wolves are declining. And then it's, we should protect wolves because wolves play this role within an ecosystem, within this Yellowstone region. And then it became, you know, we love wolves or we hate wolves or wolves are eating the things that I rely on to live. So it's fascinating to see you can have the same species and then this idea and value system around it can be wildly different.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the issues that we've had to grapple with is even within the conceptualization of sustainable use. So if you look at the way sustainable use has been conceptualized, and we've got a whole chapter that deals with it, the key thing is that there are a couple of things that go across sustainable use, and most of the biological attributes are fairly standard. So, you know, whether a population can sustain a certain level of offtake. And then that kind of matured into things like, does it have an impact on other species, for example, bycatch in the case of fisheries? Does it impact on the ecosystem? But then over and above that, the conceptualization of sustainable use has increasingly in certain areas also included values. And those vary so much between different communities. So the social and economic side, equity, social and environmental justice, animal welfare and rights, and even in some cases, the whole value chain. So for example, does logging where you're trucking timber over a long distance, does it have climate change impacts? So there are all these additional issues and values which get incorporated. And so those are much more difficult to balance out. South Africa, for example, is one of the countries who allows the hunting of leopard, mostly on private land. And that's managed through a quota system, which can often be quite stringent. At its highest, I think it was about 150, although there were never 150 trophies issued. At the same time, there are these religious groups in South Africa who use leopard capes as a traditional use, where the harvest is estimated between 2,500 and 3,000 leopard a year. And at the end of the day, how do you make decisions around what's sustainable and what's not within this kind of quagmire of of different value systems and different approaches, where even the biological aspects are evaluated differently?
How do you see the intersection of sustainable use and things like climate change, things like emerging novel zoonotic diseases? How do you see these overlapping, all of these different sort of spheres of influence on biodiversity as we kind of move into the next decade or more?
For me, one of the really important developments in the last sort of 10 or so years, and is this realization that we really are part of a complex social ecological system. And oftentimes the solutions that we look at that seem simple just aren't. They end up having these unintended consequences. So if you just think, for example, of, so we might feel that bushmeat hunting has got a significant impact on mammals, and it has. And you might think, well, the solution to that obviously is just to stop bushmeat hunting. But the question then is, so where do all those people get their protein from? And in addition to the economic aspects of, you know, can they afford to get their protein from some other source? We know that, for example, livestock isn't necessarily an alternative, because livestock has its own implications for climate change and also for zoonotic diseases. So stopping people eating wildlife to, say, prevent zoonotic disease or to reduce the impacts has other consequences which then have to be managed. So it's about trying to find those solutions that meet these sort of multiple objectives, or at least don't have unintended consequences on another objective.
Humans are just another species on the landscape, affected equally by habitat and by sustainable use. It's a really nice reminder. Within the original IPBIS Global Biodiversity Assessment, it was really about highlighting the problems in these key areas of issues. Is the Sustainable Use of Wild Species Assessment that you're working on different? Is there something that it's doing differently?
The Global Assessment looked at what the issues and impacts were on biodiversity. So, for example, it highlighted this issue around overexploitation as being the major driver in marine ecosystems and the second most important driver in terrestrial ecosystems. Our mandate wasn't just to repeat that. What we were asked to do was to look at more the solution side of it. So what we have done, for example, is to try and look at trends of sustainable use. So basically trying to find, has use in terms of its sustainability got better or got worse? Are there particular areas where it's got better or worse? What's worked and what hasn't worked? So that's one whole chapter. We try and look at what the drivers of that are. So what political, social, economic, and environmental drivers have ended up making sustainable use better or sustainable use worse? What the scenarios are? And then our final chapter is about policy options. So trying to figure out what works and what doesn't work, and what are the options going forward?
And in your absolute dream scenario, what kind of an impact does this assessment have? What is the best case for you as someone who's working so deeply with it?
The first is that the main value of these assessments is to reduce uncertainty about what the science is saying so that policymakers can get on with making informed decisions. And that's, you know, a fundamental part of IPBES is that it's about the scientists getting and the experts getting together to evaluate the evidence, but in the end, it's up to the policymakers to use that. And I've witnessed a lot of acrimonious debates regarding policies around the use of wild species. So for me, first prize will be that the evidence in this assessment can really help to move policy forward in a constructive way. And that goes even to my own personal experience at a different level, because my own experience of dealing with different species in use is that sometimes the problems seem quite intractable and we keep on trying things that don't seem to work. So, I mean, for example, if I go back to cycads, we have tried innumerable things since the 1970s, and yet we still have a problem. So, and the same is true. So if you look at rhino, we've still got issues with elephant, we've still got issues with tigers, with timber. So
I really hope that the evidence that we've collected and the way we've presented it will allow people at various levels, local, national, and international, to make better decisions regarding the sustainable use of wild species.
Well, I know the level of complexity is all-time high, but so is my excitement about this kind of work and this assessment. And I really am looking forward to seeing the work that you and your colleagues have put into this. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It's been great to chat to you.
The IPBES assessment of the sustainable use of wild species was requested, among others, by CITES, who John mentioned during our chat. Just to remind everyone, CITES is the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora.
And since the founding of IPBES, we've worked closely with CITES. It's an international agreement between governments worldwide with the aim to ensure that international trade in wild animals and plants doesn't threaten the survival of species.
It was so great that Yvonne Higuero, the Secretary General of CITES, could make the time to speak to me for this podcast. CITES has jurisdiction over both flora and fauna. So we have the plant kingdom, the animal kingdom. What specifically got you into this work? Was there one or the other that really captured you early on?
If we look at exactly what is covered by CITES, I have been working a lot with timber and with trees during my career. And I like the fact that we are looking at plants and timber species that are really valuable for countries and livelihoods and local communities. So I really try to press and stress that we have to take care of flora. You may think some of them are not as beautiful as some of these charismatic animals, but they have a huge role to play in ecosystem maintenance. And in fact, the majority of species that are covered by CITES are actually plants.
My message to students is always, plants eat sun and poop oxygen. It does not get cooler than that.
Absolutely. That's a good message. Maybe I'll try to integrate that into my speeches as well.
CITES and IPBIS collaborate quite closely, and I'm curious, could you give some specific examples of how the work of IPBIS has been used by CITES?
If you look at what the main messages are from the global assessment, it really refers a lot to what CITES is doing and trying to do. To say we can lose 1 million species of fauna and flora, it also places in a context what it means to have overexploitation of wild species. As you know, that's one of the threats that came up out of the assessment. If there's experts saying that there's overexploitation, we have to see, are we exporting too much? Maybe we need to review again. Is there a proper implementation of CITES at the national level? What is missing? What are the gaps? Is it a gap in capacity building? Are there gaps in the tools that we use, like a tool that we call non-detriment finding, which can be used to figure out quotas, for example? How much can we export? So all of that lays a foundation for decisions taken by the parties. On top of that, of course, we have the whole terrible business of illegal trade. So this has also given a voice to those who have been saying we need to do more about combating wildlife trafficking and take decisions in relation to this.
Right now, we have IPBIS working on this assessment for sustainable use of wild species. What most excites you about that being out? And how do you think these results will sort of feed into those formal processes that CITES undertakes?
We had originally planned the meeting of the Conference of the Parties, which is the governing body of CITES, for March 2022. However, unfortunately, because of the COVID situation, Costa Rica, who was going to be the host, had to say that they would no longer be able to host it in March. But luckily, Panama offered to host it a little bit later in the year, in 2022, in November. So this is really good timing. There's no doubt that if the Sustainable Use Report is released sometime mid-year, it's going to be very present in the parties' minds when they're taking the decisions and considering all the agenda items for the next 3 years. And so it's super timely.
And speaking with John Donaldson, he mentioned several specific instances where illegal trade is quite problematic. So I would love to hear about the kind of problems and challenges that illegal trade does as far as CITES is concerned.
Illegal trade is an area where more focus has to be placed on. You have so many species that are being traded illegally because they're on Appendix 1. It means that no commercial trade is allowed at all. And if you think about rhino horn, for example, if you think about rosewood, there's poaching that still continues. We have, of course, the ban on ivory trade. So we regulate that as well. So work that we do, we have the monitoring the illegal killing of elephants. That is trying to reduce the possibilities of poaching by strengthening the rangers working in these protected areas. And this applies as well for rhino. And the same for rosewood. Because of the incredible illegal trade in rosewood, we're trying now to have better identification models so that customs authorities know how to recognize rosewood passing through. If you look at demand reduction, we have the demand for Totoaba swim bladders in China because the thought that it is something that gives strength and stamina. And so we have poaching of Totoaba fish in the upper Gulf of California of Mexico. So demand reduction is a very big part of the program of CITES to try to raise awareness, but also find other ways in which those who are benefiting from this type of illegal trade get treated as a major crime, because at the end of the day, these are often international criminal syndicates who are working on this trade, and you have to stop it at the top. And this is how we work in collaboration with organizations like Interpol, with the World Customs Organization, with the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, and with the World Bank on the International Consortium to Combat Wildlife Crime.
Absolutely incredible how many layers and how many people and groups are working on this. Thank you so much for sharing your time and your expertise with us.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
That was a great conversation, Britt, and it was particularly interesting to me that both John and Yvonne were talking about the importance of considering both wild plants and wild animals. I think a lot of times when people talk about species, particularly people who are not involved in biodiversity, it can often be the animal species that get a lot more of the attention.
And with animals, it's interesting because even in our personal lives, we have domestic animals, ones that are, you know, companions, and also we are animals, and there's also wild animals. And then you start to ask yourself about these words and definitions, you know, what's a wild animal?
You know, I also come from South Africa, which is where John is from. And there's a great example in the South African context of a plant, rooibos, which literally translated means the red bush, which for thousands of years was used by indigenous communities to make medicinal tea. And it was discovered by the quote unquote Western world and has become one of the most popular tea varieties globally, which of course then means it's become perhaps less of a wild product and it's become more cultivated.
Well, and it's especially interesting because if we're saying a human hand in this species makes it less wild, it's almost as if humans aren't wild. And let me tell you, as someone living in New York City, I can promise you people are the wildest things I have ever seen this year in particular. Though, you know, I'm really taken on how interconnected these are, not just the different perspectives, but the different people and organizations working on this. You know, as we heard, the sustainable use report will have an impact on CITES, who are then dealing with illegal trade challenges. And then CITES works with organizations like Interpol and the World Bank, and then they are working with scientists and with local people to stop the illegal trade. And it just keeps going and keeps going as far as how these are all connected.
It also then gives opportunities for decision makers, perhaps at slightly smaller scales, to also make an impact and a difference. I mean, one of the things that the sustainable use assessment is going to offer, ideas of what types of levels of use are sustainable, and in areas where they've become unsustainable, it will offer opportunities and suggestions for pausing use to allow recovery and restoration of those species in those areas.
Well, even if there's not an official premiere party, I really am so looking forward to the results that'll come out. And it was just amazing to speak to both of these experts about this incredibly important topic.
And that's it for Nature Insight, Speed Dating with the Future. I'm Rob Spall.
And I'm Britt Garner. Many thanks to John Donaldson and to Yvonne Higuero for joining us in this episode.
As you said, Britt, Yvonne told us how CITES works with other organizations, like Interpol, to stop illegal trade using law. So in our next episode, I'll be asking Michelle Lim, IPBIS Fellow on the Global Assessment and a senior lecturer at the Macquarie Law School in Sydney, Australia, if law is an effective tool to tackle the nature crisis.
Ooh, excellent. We are expanding the spheres even more. I'm really looking forward to finding out more, Rob.
And in the meantime, you can learn more about IPBIS's work on www.ipbis.net or on any of our social media channels. Just search for @IPBIS. That's @IPBES. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with episode 4 next week. I hope you can join us then.